The Oxford Sparks Podcast, Episode 10, Relationships, Part 1.
It's really easy to get a bit blasé about the problem of biodiversity loss. Yes, you hear it all the time. I'm sure people stop hearing it, but it really is, when you're standing there in the field looking at that mining equipment move out, you think, oh, it's going so fast, and frequently the reason for it is lack of information about what's where. I'm William Hawthorne. I'm from the Department of Plant Sciences in the University of Oxford, and I'm a James Martin Research Fellow. The main theme to what we do is botanic surveys around the world, particularly in rainforests, which, as you know, are very species rich. We're trying to survey them in a consistent manner around the world with a view to reporting how hot they are from a hotspot point of view, how many rare plants there are in different areas. And we have developed methods to do this on a very fine scale. So hectare by hectare, you can see the forest getting hotter or colder as the density of rare plants goes up or down. One of the main problems in Africa, at least, is mining related. Mines are increasingly ripping up the earth and destroying the forests. There are also problems from farming and other sources of well-documented forest loss. So what we do is we make this information available to the governments of those countries and also to the big corporations that are mining, and hopefully they will be able to use the data to avoid causing too much impact to the biodiversity and steer around them, and insofar as they can't steer around them, provide some compensatory schemes for protecting forest elsewhere or growing the rare species wherever they can. And the reason that it's good at a global level to have a large variety of species is obviously all species can do different things, have different roles. 99% of the time we haven't a clue what those roles might be. Could be to do with climatic effects that trees have, could be plants, animals that depend on them. The ecosystem might in some cases start to collapse without certain species.
William thinks that biodiversity can be misleading and prefers the term bioquality.
Bioquality really relates to the notion that in a particular area, in a particular plant community, there might not be particularly many species, might not be very diverse, but that might be the only place that certain of those species are living. In fact, there's some forests in Ghana where you have only about 10 species of tree, but three of those species are only found in a few hectares on the planet. So there's lots of individuals of those very rare species, and it's that sort of concentration of rarity that we're trying to get at using the term bioquality.
William and his team have worked in Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean and Southeast Asia.
So we go to a certain extent where people want us to go, where there's a high pressure on the forest and where people have to do environmental impact assessments, in particular mining companies, with a view to helping them plan how to do the work in a less environmentally destructive way. Obviously, a big iron ore mine, open cast mine, where they basically remove most of the mountain, you can't avoid a very large amount of damage, is unavoidable. But at least they could steer around some of the, for instance, roads going to the mine, if where possible, if only they knew which are the best places to avoid. So we do the botanical layer, reporting on where all the hotspots or high bioquality forest is.
Often the poorest communities depend most on the bioquality of the forest.
People who live locally are very dependent on these forests. I think it's probably a general equation, is the poorer you are and the worse the roads are going to your area, the less access you have to clinics and so on, the more dependent you are. So in northern Liberia, the Mano people who live there are very dependent, very aware of the plant species, and obviously particularly aware of the species that they use a lot. And so we like to use the results to demonstrate where these plant resources are that are valued locally. So there's the local valuation, there's the global valuation or bioquality score, and just a general forest type map is quite important. So wet forest, dry forest, swamp forest, making vegetation maps, also important for assessing the overall content and values of the vegetation.
Input from the local population has added depth to his data gathering.
I've spent a lot of time over the last decade or so writing so-called user-friendly field guides, hopefully user-friendly field guides, to enable both us and anyone else identify these thousands of species which can often be very similar to each other. Yes, exactly. I mean, I made a number of them. One of them was a photo guide to the forest trees of Ghana. And we also did quite a lot of research, that was also funded by DFID, into how to make a guide that is usable by, for instance, a farmer or a forester in Ghana who hasn't had any scientific education or probably, in many cases, not been to secondary school. So how can you make a guide that will fulfil the goals of a field guide, i.e. to allow you to communicate to scientists and managers of the vegetation? And we very rapidly came to the conclusion that picture-based books, the fewer words and the more pictures, the better. We also discovered it didn't actually make much difference what the pictures were, whether it's a colour photograph or... but abstract line drawings often don't go down very well with a non-technical audience. But anyone who's been to secondary school or done science, A-level for instance, or that sort of thing, can make just as good use of line drawings as photographs. But basically otherwise it doesn't make any difference what pictures are used, but pictures, pictures, pictures. And trying to rewrite some of these guides using photographs became the main goal of what we were doing for a while. So we produced a few guides, very photograph-rich guidebooks where you basically browse pictures of the bark, for instance, of large rainforest trees, and try and match your bark to it. And we've done some tests on it, tests of 20 tree, so-called 22 tree tests, where we get a whole lot of village members to go out with these books into the forest and give them 20 trees to name. And had some very positive and satisfactory results. You can normally, someone who name or knows previously 0% of the trees can at the end of the afternoon using this book identify 18 out of 20 of the trees, which is more than a professional tree spotter working for a timber company knew before they started using the guide. So from 0 to maximum speed in one afternoon, it'd be hard to get more out of a field guide, I think. At the end of the day, there's a limit to what you can do with a field guide, and at some stage you have to call in the experts, but for most purposes, it's quite possible to make very useful picture guides to enhance the communication between the scientists, the managers, and the local people.
The vegetation maps William and his colleagues are generating are helping a range of scientists from other disciplines.
We generate a lot of primary data, which then other, for instance, geographers and climate people and so on can then use in their assessments of how to mitigate against climate change, for instance. But also, just at the species level, there's lots of new species we've discovered over the years. There's Ghana, again, as I say, is a fairly well-known country botanically, but over the years of doing these surveys, I think we've discovered 20 new species, 5 new species of very large trees, timbers, massive 40-metre trees, hadn't ever been seen before or named before. What's sort of gradually coming together at the moment, in a slightly haphazard way around the world, is the increasing presence of all of this biodiversity on the internet. Both in terms of forest type and hotspots at a very fine scale, species distributions, all of these things are becoming more and more available and apparent on the internet. Maybe we'll soon be able to map tree species based on their satellite profile. That's possible, although it's not very reliable at the moment to do that in a rainforest. But even if you can do that, I can't see that happening for understory shrubs and begonias and lianes anytime soon. So you can't get away from the fact that more and more surveys have got to be done to work out what's sitting there. So yes, definitely a need for more surveys of the ever-dwindling patches of rainforest around the world. But I can see it all coming together. You know, one of them, the forest is declining as their knowledge about them goes up. Soon they'll sort of meet in the middle. We'll have a fairly good handle on what little bit of rainforest is remaining. So by doing this research, hopefully, we will be able to hold back a little bit that terrible wave of destruction that's going on.
You've been listening to the Oxford Sparks podcast, narrated by me, Lou Sumner, and produced by Steve Pritchard for the University of Oxford. For more fascinating science, visit www.oxfordsparks.ox.ac.uk.